How concerned that when you started to power up the capsule, that something, if stuff had frozen, that if it didn't thaw properly, yeah, you would lose capability? Was there any of that consideration? Well,
for me, that was the most, I felt the highest, call it concern or pressure, because we were going to do something we had not trained to do. This is a fairly lengthy procedure. Normally we'd have done that numbers of dozens of times in a simulator if you know you had to do it. And so Jack and I did that power up while Jim kept maintained attitude and kept communication from the limb. And all we could do was read through it, and we talked to each other to get the flow of the procedure. And it was pushed late so as not to use too much of the entry, small entry batteries up. And so we really worried about a screw-up, like, and maybe it wouldn't have been that. There might have been a caution warning light come on that normally would come on, but you'd have to stop and worry about what to do about it. But again, what was done on the ground and verified in that procedure was perfect. We had no stops at all that way, and on board at least, to have to slow down or stop. The only thing we worried about was the water. On board, Jack and I agreed that as we pushed in the circuit breakers on the two big circuit breaker panels, we'd only push in, we'd time ourselves and only push in six at a time. And that way we could smell for burning insulation and back up and start pulling circuit breakers back out and try to isolate which one maybe the short was on. So that's how we did that part of the power up, which only did it six circuit breakers at a time.
Bill.
You know, you need to understand that normally when we would come back in and re-enter, it's just the command and service module. And at the very last minute, you separate from the service module, and the command module has the heat shield on it that comes on in. In this configuration, you had the lunar module stuck on it. And we always had a motto in the lunar module world that heat shields were for sissies, because, you know, to land on the moon, you didn't need a heat shield. So there was no heat shield. You couldn't come in the lunar module. So as they were saying, it was a very time-critical procedure based on how much battery power was in the command module entry batteries to transfer an alignment from the lunar module to the command module at the last minute, then close it out and jettison the lunar module.
So at what point in terms of hours before, you know, your anticipated touchdown in the water, did you jettison the limb? How soon were you able to do that?
That
with
was
confidence?
Fairly late. I'm not too sure what it was, but
it was just minutes prior to entry interface.
Really?
I mean,
wow.
Before we hit the atmosphere, of course.
Yeah.
So how did the rest of it go? I mean, in this whole process that you just described, Fred.
Oh, they're here.
Yeah.
That was my only entry. Jim may have a different aspect of how it went. The most unusual thing to me was, again, the water. We were in a light rain shower at first because we hit started building up G's that fell out from behind the panel on us for a while. But again, one of these incredible things, we had violated every specification on that vehicle, and yet it came back to life. And if you look at the Apollo overall mission report and you look at entry performance, you would see that we had the second most accurate splashdown of the entire program. Only Apollo 10 hit it closer.
Let me back up just a little bit. As we were coming in, getting all squared away, we had to do a couple things. We had to jettison the service module before we hit the atmosphere, which is a normal procedure, of course. And then, of course, we had to jettison the lunar module, the vehicle that brought us home, because it had no way of getting through the atmosphere. It has no heat shield. And there was a couple switches in the command module that would do those functions. And so at the proper time, we jettisoned the service module. And as it tumbled on by, Fred and I saw this big panel missing from the thing, and we took some pictures to get a better idea eventually when we got back what really happened. And then what we were thinking about was, because these two switches were very close together, that hopefully, because we were still in the lunar module, that he wouldn't mislabel or hit the wrong switch, which would mean he would jettison the lunar module with Fred and I in it and no way of going through the atmosphere. But he put a little sign on there, a little piece of paper that said, no. So make sure he jettisoned the right vehicle.
Jim, at what point did you, Fred, Jack, able to look out and see the service module finally and really see in your own eyes what had happened?
Well, we were in the lunar module, so we had a chance, as it drifted on by, to take pictures of it and tell Mission Control what we saw. And that's why we want to make sure that he jettisoned the right vehicle, because we were still there.
The Fred, this was your first flight, yes? What's bottom line, as you look back over that, quote, first flight of yours, what did you come away from that experience?
Well, I wish Jim would have kept 14.
But, yeah, you're right.
But, no, I guess I was obviously extremely disappointed when this went awry, because losing the chance to land. I thought I may get back, because I backed up John Young on 16, and at that time 19 was still a real mission. And I thought I might get back to the moon on 19, and of course I had a second disappointment. But if you say, looking back from today, I just feel incredibly fortunate, privileged to have been alive at the right time to take part in the Apollo program and have the opportunity I had.
Jim, take us back to Apollo.
First of all, to go on with what Fred had said, let me think back a little bit. What would have happened if Apollo 13 did not have the explosion, that we landed on the moon, picked up some lunar rocks, said some forgettable words, got back safely? There wouldn't have been any movie. Those words, Houston, we got a problem, would never have occurred in our language, or failure is not an option. And so I was very frustrated, like Fred, when we did not land on the moon. And then after years had gone by, I said, in retrospect, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to NASA, because things were getting very routine by that time. People were losing interest. And suddenly, the fact that they took an almost certain catastrophe and Michigan brought back to a successful recovery was really something that everybody could be proud of, because it brought out the leadership that we had. It brought out the teamwork that we were working with, and it brought out that initiative that was necessary. So in retrospect, although I'm sorry I didn't land, I think it was probably the best thing that happened to the NASA program.
Milton, yeah, Milton.
Well, I was just going to say, another aspect of that is later on we realized the reaction of the world to all that, and the world just came together in a unified way. Too bad it didn't last, but it was really amazing how they responded to that activity, and that wouldn't have happened either.
Right. Bill and Milton, as you look back over your careers, and as I mentioned in the introduction, I mean, you all were involved from Mercury on through all these programs. And how fulfilling has that been for you professionally to have had such a major personal role in our space programs over the last decades?
Well, Mercury and Gemini was before my time, so I didn't get involved in the program until Apollo, at the very start of Apollo. And but it was such an incredible adventure. I mean, you realize when Apollo 13 happened, I was sitting on a console in Mission Control, and I was 25 years old, as were most of the engineers in there. I think the average age of the entire agency when we landed on the moon in Apollo 11 was 28 years old.
You want to repeat that so everybody...
The average age across the entire agency, entire NASA agency at the Apollo 11 landing was 28. And, you know, there were people in their 40s or whatever, but there were an awful lot of young engineers. I know the class that I was hired right out of college in 1967. I reported on June 6, 1967 to Houston, and right out of college. And the class that I got hired in was a very large class of engineers, but it was one of the last major hiring classes for the Apollo program. And
I happened to get out of the Air Force at a time when they were just starting the manned spacecraft program. In fact, almost a little before they did, and I worked at Langley. And so I was started with a Mercury program early on. And I always looked back and thought that I was really lucky and that I was in the right place at the right time. The people let us, gave us a job to do, gave us the resources to do it. And as Bill said, they gave young engineers a chance to do things that they wouldn't think of doing today. In fact, I don't believe we could go back to the moon again like we did before. Maybe we could, but it was an amazing experience, and it worked all the way through Skylab and into the station and the shuttle, and it was an amazing time to be young and alert.
But we would love to have the challenge to go back to the moon today.
Jim, take us back to Apollo 8. You, Frank, Borman, Bill Anders, going around the moon, you're the first time. What was your impression that first time you went around the back of the moon and came out and saw the Earth, the first people ever to have done that? How did that affect you?
Well, of course, that affected me a lot differently than 13. 13 was a challenge to get back home. Apollo 8 was actually, I think, one of the high points of my space career. I was the navigator, and there was a 240,000-mile trip out to a planet that no one has been to before, and we went out there and we were able to circle the thing at 60 miles, nautical miles, and we looked at the moon, for the far side of the moon, for the very first time. We were like three school kids looking at a candy store window. But the most impression I got, and it's been said many times, was the Earth itself. To see the Earth at a distance of just 240,000 miles, which is just a drop in the bucket as far as space goes itself. And we could put up our thumb, as I've mentioned many times, and hide the Earth behind my thumb, which meant that everything that I ever knew was behind my thumb. My loved ones, the country, the world, the problems, the whole thing. And it dawned on me how insignificant we really all are. And then again, how fortunate we all are to live on a planet of the proper mass that will contain water and an atmosphere, and at the proper distance from our sun, not too close, not too far away, that provides the energy that lets life evolve. So we should all be very fortunate of what we have here.
Ladies and gentlemen, Milton Windler, Bill Reeves, Fred Hayes, Jim Lovell. Thanks, Jim. as always, Nick.